languages. So I feel like when I'm not a native speaker of Spanish, but my Spanish is not terrible. It serves me. I can use it. I can get by. I can communicate. I can work in it. I have worked in it as a linguist. I've done lots of high level things with it, but I'm way more honest when I speak Spanish because I don't have all the tricks. I don't have all the vocabulary. I don't know how to manipulate the language to well enough to be able to hide behind little stories that I make up the way I can in English. So I feel like I think differently. It's like way more elemental for me when I speak Spanish. It's like right to the heart of the matter, because I don't have the tools to make up too much of a story. So I feel like, yeah, I have a different way of being in the world when I switch to Spanish. I feel like, I don't know, it's different. Some perspective has shifted. I think I listen better because I have to. I don't listen as well in English, but I really have to pay attention in Spanish and Dutch too. Like, I learned enough Dutch to take care of my business when I lived in the Netherlands. I was there almost 8 years and I worked really hard on it. I think I just have different perspectives, different ways of feeling and being depending on what language I'm in. You can do different things in different languages. You can, and you get a different perspective. But in terms of like how that affects society as a whole, you know, I really don't know. Like, another place I spent some time was Montreal in the 80s, almost 4 years. I went to college there, and okay, that's a multilingual city, right? French and English, and there's Haitian Creole, and you can hear Spanish, and there are lots of people speaking Chinese there. There's a Chinatown there, a lot of Portuguese speakers, Greek, Italian. But okay, how at ease people were, because, you know, there was also this politicization of French and English up there when I lived there, and I think still it's still an issue. So that always seemed pretty restrictive to me. Like, if you were an English speaker and you spoke English in the east part of Montreal, like east of Saint Laurent Street, you know, especially if you were a Canadian English speaker, they were loose, but like you couldn't. You would just get the cold shoulder. It was a political act. It was like, you don't do that. You didn't go to the east part of Montreal and speak English if you didn't have to, because it was just perceived as like imposing your dominant culture will. Even though you're in Quebec, it was still like Canada, monolingual English. It was really not well received. On the other hand, as a person who was starting to realize that she was queer, it was like way easier than being in Miami, where no way, you know, like that's a tough place for women who are queer. That back in the 80s it was, and you had to, you know, hide it a lot. And in Montreal it was pretty free, and no one made a big deal about it, and you felt safe that way. I was looking at factors that influence minority language retention, and so I picked Arabic because in my family people speak Arabic or did speak Arabic. My grandparents and great-grandparents, and my dad grew up speaking it, and so I was interested. And then I grew up in Miami and learned a lot of Spanish and became a teacher of Spanish, and so I was interested in Spanish. So I was looking at, like, how does Arabic get retained in the U.S. and mainly in Michigan, how does Spanish get retained in the U.S.? And the processes seemed a little different, you know. It seemed like for Spanish, when you look at communities in Miami and California, like those communities gain traction because people have access to more money, to more political processes. And so they gain traction that way. Like, well, we have politicians in power from our communities, we have newspapers, we have media presence, we have, you can live in Miami and never speak English, you know, or New York or parts of California. I mean, you don't have to, and the communities are thriving. They're not the languages in any danger of dying out. It seemed a little different to me for Arabic, although that might have changed. I wrote this piece in the 90s and things were different. So it seemed like more folks in the Arabic speaking community were preserving their language just because they wanted to. Like, well, they want to, they're proud of it. They want to keep the traditions going. So they keep speaking it. It's a little bit of a different process, like ethnic pride, I called it at the time. Now I'm not sure that's a reasonable metric, but I did find sources to back up what I was saying at the time. What happens is people just figure out what languages they need to learn to make their lives happen. Like, what do I need to learn to survive? What do I need to learn to work? And they learn what they need to do those things. So I think that's why, anyone who moves to a particular region where they don't know the language has to learn, a little enough to be able to do their business, or hope that their language is already spoken there. So, like in Amsterdam, you can live in English if you know English, but it's not something you can force. Like, people just will go, oh, I need to learn this. Like, you come to the US, you want to get a job, you learn the language of the community that you're going to get a job in.
And if I know anything at all, it's that a wall is just a wall and nothing more at all. It can be broken down.
Et si je peux en conclure quoi que ce soit, un mur n'est qu'un mur, rien de plus. Et un mur, ça peut être détruit.
وإذا كنت أدرك أي شيء على الإطلاق فذلك أن الحائط هو مجرد حائط ولا شيء غير ذلك على الإطلاق يمكن تحطيمه.
而且如果我知道什么的事，那墙就是墙，仅此而已，它可以被拆除.
Y si algo sé es que un muro es solo un muro y nada más. Puede descomponerse.
Og hvis jeg ved noget overhovedet, så er det en væg. Er bare en væg, og ikke mere end det. Den kan blive brudt ned.
And if I know anything at all, it's that a wall is just a wall and nothing more at all. It can be broken down.
Caresser la mitraille, cette plaie qui me tiraille, le palais des autres jours.
I was a sociologist for a great many years at York University in Toronto, and I'm retired now. Sociology is primarily focused on urban populations, cities, the different kinds of groups that make up cities, how diverse they are. My own specialty in sociology was both communication studies and also racism and anti-racism, ethnic groups, what we call ethnic groups in Canada, the way in which they live together, compete with each other for space and for time, and how they've done historically over the years. In sociology, there was a lot of emphasis on the parts of the cities that were occupied by different groups and classes. And much of that came out of Chicago. In the early days, with a sociologist named Everett C. Hughes, the feeling was that when people moved in from the hinterland, whether they were Afro-Americans from the South or Polish immigrants or people from Europe, the people that did the hard manual labor, they moved into the center of the city, into what we think of as the slums now. And then gradually, as the class divisions grew, people moved out to the periphery of the city, so that the richer people were living on the outskirts of the city. And that has all reversed in the last 20, 30 years, with wealthier people now going back into the center of the city, displacing the people that used to live in the center and taking over their neighborhoods. I was told by a lawyer that one of the most frequent civic disputes in cities, it has to do with property lines. And this has become more and more endemic in cities where there are, where the prices of property has escalated crazily. And I've heard about it in, of course, in Toronto, where people are concerned about the property line, because every inch of their land is now very, very valuable. And if you want to build on it, if you want to build another thing, if you want to sell it, the number of square feet that you're selling is very important. And I've heard of it in San Francisco, too. In San Francisco, even in Lake County, in Santa Cruz, in Mill Valley, in all these places, I've heard of property line disputes between neighbors, especially where one moves in afterwards and says, no, you've encroached on my property. And it may be a matter of 2 or 3 feet, but they get into very heated legal struggles over this, spend thousands and thousands on lawyers and on surveyors, drawing lines and so on, to find out what their land is. And this kind of territoriality, I think, is stronger now than I've ever seen it in my lifetime. It didn't exist when I was young. There's a lot of dispute about how effective walls are. For a long time, it took much military might with the Berlin Wall to keep it intact and keep the people from not, in the east side of the wall, from trying to make it into the west. Of course, they were the allure of the west, and all of the goods that were in West Berlin was very attractive, especially when you have media globalization. People could see on television and so on how all the things, all the material things that people on the other side, they wanted those things too. These boundaries that were established by colonial regimes are ones that mark so much of the world. The whole Soviet Union, before it broke down and became a whole bunch of different, quite independent countries in Middle Eastern type countries, or we see it in China, where China is so concerned with walling in the Uyghurs and keeping them in re-educational centers. They're really like minor concentration camps, where and they're putting them to work in factories, producing things for the West, and the West looks the other way on all this for the most part. In the Middle East, you have the Kurds, who span three different countries at least, and there's a lot of questions. Should they have their own territorial area so that a country, the country of Kurdistan? Turkey doesn't believe so, and is prepared to go to battle and slaughter them by the thousand. In this country, you have gated communities all over the country. The South especially is marked by gated communities. Florida is filled with them, and often they are ethnically homogeneous inside the gated community, and they're keeping out whoever it is, Haitians, Afro-Americans, Hispanics, this kind of thing, who come in to do the yard work and the gardening and so on and leave at the end of the day. And often with these gated communities, I don't know if you've ever gone into them, you announce yourself, it's like a doorman. The gates open up for you to go in. and it's almost like going into a prison.
My name is Dan O'Brien, and I live in San Francisco.
I understand you have a front wall in front of your house, and so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, like what, why you like having that wall.
I really wouldn't call it a wall. It's a wooden fence. You know, a wall to me is like a big, giant cinder block or concrete kind of structure. But this is just a wooden fence. I would call it a fence.
Okay.
But I guess you could call it a wall. But I call it a fence. This is not the best neighborhood. It's a rough neighborhood. There are break-ins and thefts and wandering people. And I think without it, it would leave the house exposed and vulnerable to criminal activity. Yeah, it's a busy street. And, you know, any kind of solid structure will keep some of that noise down. But, you know, I don't think that's its main function. Without it, the yard would be filled with trash. I mean, the wind just blows, you know, outside on the sidewalk up against the fence. There's like piles of trash that just get blown around all over the place. You know, we also have a like kind of a backyard. So, I mean, if the fence wasn't there, you know, someone could easily get around to the back and, you know. Well, we have some community cats that live back there that we take care of. And, you know, people walk their pit bulls here and sometimes pit bulls off leash and or any dogs off leash, and it could cause a problem for those cats. I like the fence. You know, this is a neighborhood where just about everybody has a 8-foot high fence or wall in front of their house. I mean, so it's not unusual to see it. I think I might feel funny about it if, like, you know, I was like, you know, the one white guy that moved into the neighborhood and then put up like a giant, you know, 8-foot high fence, but that's just not the case here.
My name is Sarah Moss. I'm a certified mediator, and I'm also the mediation and training coordinator for Community Boards in San Francisco. Community Boards is the nation's very first and longest running mediation service in the United States, and we have been in operation for 48 years now. We are officially recognized as a legacy business in the Bay Area as well, and we are very proud of that. I was raised in San Francisco. I was a professional dancer and theater artist. I went to community college. I got a theater degree. I traveled around the world. I did all those things. And so at some point, I realized that I really couldn't survive as a starving artist. It's fun, but, you know, sometimes you gotta, like, take it up a notch, pay the bills. That wasn't happening. So I decided to go back to school. I went to SF State. And I got my bachelor's in communications, and I also got a certification in conflict resolution and mediation. And that's how I found Community Boards. And then I went through the basics of mediation training, which we offer every year. You know, and then I started mediating. That was my goal. Then I went on to be outreach coordinator, and now here I am doing mediation and training coordinator. I also guest lecture at SF State and UC Berkeley on mediation. So a lot of really amazing things have come out of my work with Community Boards. Now, as far as Community Boards background, it was founded in 1976 by Raymond Sean Holes, who was a professor of law at USF. And he collaborated with a team of people who really cared about fostering democracy within their community. The 70s were a time of many impactful social movements. And that gave this small storefront, it was literally a little storefront organization, a lot of traction with people because they were suddenly open and thinking about empowerment and community work coming together. There were wars going on. There were race relations going on. There were women's movements going on. So this was an attractive field. This was an attractive organization because it was taking away the intrusion of police and lawyers to resolve their disputes. And that was a successful journey. And now, thanks to our founders, that team of people in their little storefront, we have this legacy that they left us. And luckily, mediation is really commonplace now, and our model has been taken all over the world. We offer neighborhood and specialized mediations. And now that we have finessed our remote work, we also work with people all over the country and sometimes internationally via Zoom, obviously. That the pandemic actually did us a favor because we love in person, but when we got used to working on Zoom, suddenly we had people coming from Thailand, the deep woods of Alaska, Europe, Spain, Asia, all these people from all over who are now training with us and working with us, which is amazing. The primary focus of the community board's mediation approach is conciliation. It's the building or rebuilding of human relationships. We believe that a conflict belongs to the participants, as does the responsibility for its resolution. We also believe that unless the underlying feelings and the interests and needs are addressed in the conflict, any resolutions that are made will eventually prove to be superficial, very common. Unresolved resentments, unmet needs, and anger will ultimately resurface to sabotage the existing resolution or will spark a whole new conflict. For this reason, our approach to mediation takes into account not only the specific issues at hand, but the feelings of the participants as well. So to get more into the nitty-gritty, as someone calls and speaks to our case developer and opens a mediation case with us, or after they call, we invite the parties in conflict to join a panel with the three mediators and one observer, that's usually someone who just finished their training, and to discuss the conflicts at hand. Everyone has the right to accept or decline the offer of mediation. It's not like a court case where you're being served a summons to appear. Once everyone agrees, we do three-hour sessions so that they can really unpack the issues without rushing. In the three-hour session, we help the parties not only organize their thoughts, but we also give them equal time to discuss their concerns. We ask that they state a summary of concerns and their individual goals. Then we continue to lead them through the discussion from there with the intention of staying neutral and maintaining guidelines for better communication by reminding the parties to be respectful, don't interrupt. They have had time to speak directly to the panel first in the session. Then they speak to each other in the session. At the end, if all goes well, the mediation panel will write up an agreement and they will walk through some agreements that they would like to put in writing. If they choose, we don't press for a resolution, but oftentimes they do make some kind of agreement. Even people who it seems like this is never going to work, there's not going to be any headway here, somehow they manage to pen even one task, which is amazing. This is a facilitative approach, allowing parties to engage themselves into coming up with solutions rather than doing it for them. Oftentimes, people will burn bridges when they seek litigation, whereas mediation has the potential to create a bridge of peace between parties and maintain positive relationships. When people lawyer up and they put everyone through a court system, it can possibly damage any future chance of being friends or good neighbors again, because it is a long, drawn out, very, very expensive process. And even though you might get what you wanted, at the end of the day, you might be living next door to someone that you feel completely uncomfortable ever speaking to again. There are cases where it won't work and they'll try and you will have to take the litigation route. But most people these days are encouraged to try to mediate first. People want to be heard. They want to feel safe, but at the end of the day, they want to be liked. And sometimes just having your neighbor that you've been fighting with for years and years say, you know, I really do, I still like you. And I miss the times when we used to have lemonade and play bingo in the yard. No, they don't care anymore, but they're fighting about. The biggest issue we have in the Bay Area is the housing crisis. All roads seem to lead to the housing crisis. It's something to do with their habitation. It brings up a lot of issues for people, being stuck with unsuitable roommates because they have nowhere to go, poor living conditions, fractured romantic relationships because they can't afford to move, ineffective landlords and property managers, they're not listening to their tenants, sparring over parking spaces, noise, lack of safety in their buildings. The other big issue that comes up are trees. They grow and they grow. They're so beautiful, but people don't want to maintain them. And it creates a lot of friction between neighbors. So many tree calls, just trees gone wild, my friends, especially after a storm. You have to be able to slow down and listen. You have to be willing to observe not only with your ears, but with your eyes. People's body language can tell you so much. You have to learn how to ask open-ended questions. Now, as a role play coach in our basics of mediation training, I work with the students in the basics training, and the hardest thing, the thing they struggle with the most, is open-ended questions. It sounds really easy, but we really do gravitate towards yes and no. The best trait you can have is to be able to slow down and think about the question you're going to ask, because if you ask an open-ended question, it just opens this Pandora's box of details that will give you, will illuminate your mind on what's going on in front of you. But it also, more importantly, it illuminates their mind on what's going on with them. Sometimes if you ask an open-ended question, they will answer in great detail and they'll have an epiphany just from answering your question, which is a beautiful thing to see. What you might see as a minor issue that isn't a big deal could be a life-changing stressor for someone else. Approach all conflict in earnest, even if you think it seems trivial. In order to succeed, you have to remain neutral at all times. If you nod your head or grin at the wrong moment, people might interpret that as a mediator taking sides. People are very sensitive. Even the ones who seem tough, most of the time they're not. That's what I've noticed. It is really important to keep a straight face and not react. Just listen and ask, again, open-ended questions. That's the biggest thing. Don't ask a question starting with why. It can sound judgmental to people and they will start to shut down, especially if you ask why to only one of them. Any sign of bias can completely ruin any progress you might be making in the session. So that's what I've learned from being in mediations. Like I said, we're sensitive creatures. One more thing I would like to say is if you visit communityboards.org, you can learn more about our services. You can also sign up for our trainings, which we offer several times a year. We have 40-hour basics of mediation trainings. I can certify you, yes, you, as a volunteer community mediator, as well as conflict coaching courses. And you can also be a volunteer conflict coach. And there are shorter one-day classes that focus on different topics that can enhance your job skills and practice. You don't have to be a mediator or a lawyer to benefit from these trainings. We have people from all over the world of all levels and professions attending. It's a great skill to have, and it looks very good on your resume.
I must have my hat. Whether you like it or not, I must have my hat.
Well, what are you going to do? Come over
I'm going to take it.
It's against the regulations.
Suppose that's double line anyway.
No, I can't let you do that, mate.
This is my hat that I'm asking you to
do. No, mate. Technically, now, it's mine. Belongs
what?
To yours.
How do you figure that?
Well, it's over here. Look, I can't. I'm not allowed to talk on this blooming line.
Did you see me with the hat on?
Yeah, I thought you looked very nice in it. But you bunged it over here. You dropped it off your nut, and it's on the ground.
Well, that means that I lose my hat?
Well, I don't know if you lose it. I expect if it goes through the proper channels, you get it back in a few months.
What channels are you
speaking of? I don't know what channels. I'll give it to the man who puts it in the channels, and then you apply.
Look at all those animals passing across this line. And yet, we, the higher form of life here.
I can't talk.
Listen, you had better give me my hat.
Yes.
Yes, you better give me my hat.
Look, mate, it's on my side. I mean, if you...
It's my hat.
Well, I know, but if you try anything, boy, I mean, you come over here and I'm afraid you're going to get...
I'm going to get what?
Thank you for listening to part 4 of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors. Or Do They? The poem Affirmation, written by Asada Shakur, was read by Samantha Rogers and Lujain Asale. A multilingual collage of the same poem included Samantha and Lujain, as well as Eva Sonson, Wael Buhesi, David Liu, Mary Salomi, and Kelly Robertson. Tara Vadri read the poem Mending Wall, written by Robert Frost. Music by Jamie Branch, Labyrinth, Nicole Mitchell, David Hudson, Sophie Hunger, and Dizzy Gillespie and Dudley Moore from the animated film The Hat by Faith and John Hubley. We want to thank Kevin Wolf, Coleman Romales, Margaret Salome, Sarah Moss, Emmeline, and Dan for their willingness to be part of this program. This show was produced by Mary Salome and Emily Charles, a Queer in Your Ear production.